Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your book inspector, and this week's guest is Nikesh Shukla, the author, broadcaster and essayist. His third novel, the one who wrote Destiny, was published to great acclaim by Atlantic Books this spring. It's a story about love, pain and stand-up comedy. Nikesh is the creator and editor of the best-selling essay collection, The Good Immigrant, published by Unbound, which features essays from 21 writers of colour discussing race and immigration in the UK. He lives in Bristol, but it was tricky to make a date to see his bookshelves, so he told us all about them during a chat in London. It's worth mentioning that we recorded this conversation several months ago, so many of the projects Nikesh talks about are now out and available to buy. Think of this as a chance to enjoy some small-scale time travel. I am here in our special interrogation chambers with Nikesh Shukla. What do you remember reading when you were little that you had to be quite secretive about? Did you do much reading under the covers or taking things from the library or buying books that your family would not have approved of?
Yeah. So my weird story, like my parents didn't really read to me as a kid. I don't remember there being a lot of kids' books in our house, if any, but my mum was really good about taking us to the library. From the age of like three till maybe, I think it may have only have been a year or maybe 2 years, but my entire family lived in one house, and so I shared, I don't know if I should admit this, it's sort of awful. I, as a three-year-old, shared a bedroom with my dad's 16-year-old brother, and he was at college and studying, and like, I would want to go to sleep and he would want to study, and we had a really fractious relationship, which we still do to this day, but it's because we shared the tiniest room and he was a teenager and I was a child.
And he was your uncle, but it was more like a relationship of brothers.
It was really odd. And then when they moved out, when he moved out, like, and I had my own room, my mum was always really good about taking me and my sister to the library. She always thought buying books was a waste of money. When you had access to the library, so we spent a lot of time in libraries. And the one thing that my mum never like censored us or like was worried about was whether we were reading. So I was like, I tried to read Crime and Punishment when I was like 13 years old and what have you. But
How did you find it? Did you finish it?
I gave up. I didn't get it. I really didn't get it. So I kind of found myself reading a lot of stuff like way before I should have read them or really knew what they were about. So like I remember obsessing about Adrian Mole when I was like 8 years old, not really getting a lot of the stuff that was in it, and not really getting that it was a book that, I guess, like having been a 13 year and a 3/4 year old, you then read it. You don't read it at 13 and 3/4.
Because I suppose it's almost like YA fiction for adults, isn't it? Yeah. That everybody connects with that. But because obviously Sue Townsend is, I think, one of the funniest writers that has ever existed.
But the thing about that book, and like I had, like I would be able to freely get that book and Teenage Health Freak and like the Paul Zindel books out of the library without worrying, and then like I'd lend them to my mates because their parents were a bit hotter on what they should and shouldn't be reading.
So you were running the semi-legal lending library.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. But like the one book that I got from the library that had the biggest impact on me was so I saw the advert for the BBC adaptation of The Buddha of Suburbia, and I was like, wow, there's a brown guy who's, can I swear?
Yeah.
There's a brown guy who's like fucking and like taking loads of drugs and listening to rock and roll and
having sex with everybody.
Yeah, this looks amazing. But I knew that because there was one TV in the house, because it was the 80s and 90s, like my parents would watch that. They would always watch the 9 o'clock news. I think it was on at 9 o'clock, and I just knew they weren't going to let me watch The Buddha of Suburbia. But I, from the advert, I gleaned that it was based on the book. So I was like, I don't care if I get out of the library because that's just reading. So I got out of the library and I really remember reading that first line, my name is Kareem Amir and I'm an Englishman through and through, almost. And that one word almost was like, it was like the first time I'd felt seen as a, like, a weird teenage brown kid who went to a predominantly white school. And
how old were you?
Like 14, 15, I think. And like that's part of why I think it's really important that people feel represented, is that I want everyone to have that Buddha of Suburbia moment where they read a story and they resonate, that story resonates with them so much that they don't feel weird, or they don't feel alone, or they don't feel isolated. Or they read that story and they see the perspective of someone else who's like living a completely different life to them, and they can find their universality in that as well. So that book's really important to me. And I guess if my mum had known that I'd read it at the time, then she probably would have, maybe she would have been like, maybe don't read that.
Is that a book you'd like to share with your own children when they're ready? Presumably not now. Or do you think it's something that you hope they find for themselves?
I hope they find their Buddha of Suburbia, because there's no, you know, when you like, I love this so much, you have to read it, you will love it as much as I do. And then you read it and you go, it's all right. Like, that's how I fear, like, you know, when something gets overhyped, when someone tells you this is the most important book in my life and it will be the most important book in your life, that's a lot of pressure. It so heavily depends on when you come to these things as well, that they really resonate.
You mentioned, you know, being an ambitious reader and getting books out and not finishing them. In your house, do you have any classics on your shelf that sort of look good, but perhaps you haven't got to the end of? Or are there any books that, again, you know, popular opinion or other people's opinion says this is great, but you've just not really had that moment of connection?
I'm really lucky to get books, and like I've got I'm judging the Folio Prize at the moment, so I've got a post Folio Prize reading thing that of books that I really must get through. But so like the first part of your question, I'm really badly read when it comes to the canon and to classics. I read a lot of comics and a lot of comics was probably the thing that my parents really hated me reading. They thought they were a waste of money and they thought they were melting my brain. Like, little did they know that comics would be like, or like those characters would be like the most lucrative characters in the world. But
which comics did you read?
Spider-Man. I was obsessed with Spider-Man growing up, and Daredevil and Batman. But I've not read that many classics, and I think I've tried. So like, I asked for Bleak House one Christmas, and like, I read a page of it, and I didn't really get into it. And in terms of like books that people love that I really hate, like, I can't stand Jonathan Franzen. I really hate his stuff. I just find it smug. And like, there's two tropes of book that I really hate. One is like the great American novel where archetypal Donald Draper-esque man walks into a room, picks up a mug. Mug reminds him of his childhood. We have 70 pages of childhood reminiscences. The mug falls and smashes to the ground. He's then sad for 400 pages. And then you have the other trope, which is like sad, middle-aged, creative writing professor has sex with his impossibly attractive younger student and then is a bit sad for another 400 pages. Like, and those, like, Finkler Question or Zoo Time or whatever it was, that won the Booker, didn't it? And Freedom, everyone loved Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, but I couldn't bear it. Just read it and I thought, these people are awful.
I tried and I kept dropping off.
It's awful. And it's not, it doesn't tell me anything about America. It tells me a lot about some really privileged white people.
A lot about Jonathan Franzen.
Yeah.
Why do you think they have such an enormous appeal? Do you think it's the, you know, the confidence and audacity? There's the, what's the like, give me the confidence of a mediocre white man. And people just take them at their own estimation, that you must be reading my book, it's very good. I suppose it probably is quite good.
I wonder if it's, my friend Rosanna was telling me recently that like, when men and women look at a job specification for a job, like if a man can tick off two of those things, he'll apply for it. But women, more often than not, will only apply if they can tick off like three quarters of it. That's how I feel about books. Like, male authors definitely have the audacity of like, one person has told me this is the best thing ever, therefore it is the best thing ever. This is a person who says, I refuse to write about black people because I don't have any black friends. And it's like, there's two wrong things with that statement. maybe a third.
But that's come up a lot when reading about the writing routines of men and women, and I'm generalising enormously, but I know that men tend to say, I will be in my study between 10 and 6 and I'm not to be disturbed and you must take the children away and, you know, no one, if anybody comes, I will murder them and that will be legal because I've said so. But women tend to have to scribble in notebooks and people just burst on them all the time and say, oh, you're doing your writing, you're not doing anything important. I mean, how, because I do think that anyone being a writer, it does take a lot of audacity to have that leap in your heart that believes, I think people will want to read what I have to say. When do you think that happened for you? Did you always write and connect with writing? Was there something that made you feel confident enough to really go for it?
That's a good question. I don't know what the moment was. I know that I write to kind of figure stuff out. I'm not very good at talking things out. I need to write.
Doing it. All right here.
Well, I'm just like maligning authors. my first novel is about me trying to like figure out what was going on for me as a teenager. My second novel is about me reconciling like a time in my life where I was grieving my mum, and to avoid grieving my mum, I spent a lot of time on social media. My third novel is about me trying to like figure my family out and celebrate them. I definitely write because I'm wrestling with something internal. I'm like asking myself big questions of myself. I don't know what the point was where I was like, other people need to read this. But I guess you write enough stuff, you kind of start to think, well, it'd be nice to have readers for this. We all like validation. I guess in a weird way, I suppose more specifically with The Good Immigrant, like the reason for doing The Good Immigrant was so people would have their Buddha of Suburbia moment that I had.
And it's so brilliant to do that with so many different voices, I think.
Yeah, because like, my role in that was as a curator. And, you know, it's interesting thinking about like if you'd had 10 other editors, you would have had ten different sets of essays in that book, but because my tastes tend to lean towards funny, the book ends up being funny.
It's true, but I do think sometimes levity is lacking. I think that humour is often the hardest thing to get right, and it, in a time when, you know, what the world needs now, we need all the joy we can lay our hands on. And I think that critically sometimes, I don't think this happened at all with The Good Immigrant. You know, I don't know a person who didn't sort of just adore it and think it was a wholesale fantastic book. But I know, you know, other writers I love, well, I suppose like P.G. Wodehouse is maybe an example of someone who, in a weird way, you know, he always wrote sort of the same story over and over and over again, but every time did it with such lightness and deftness. I guess sort of Nancy Mitford as well. And they're writers who, because they have written something that's almost so sort of digestible, and it's something that you might pick up when you feel sad, or, you know, it's not weighty like a Franzen. And I don't think they get the credit for the fact that something that is so easy to read is actually requires an awful lot of, you know, talent and effort to write.
Or can wrestle with some really big things.
Mm. Which, I think, you know, The Good Immigrant sort of certainly did to...
Yeah. And I think we're in a curious time with comedy because I guess this is specifically around like political comedy. Like for me, good comedy, good satire is about kicking upwards. It's about speaking truth to power, and it's never about kicking downwards. And so like, I think this is sort of weird thing happening where lots of comedy conversations seem to be about censorship and free speech and like comedians or comedy writers wanting to tell jokes that kick downwards and not face any criticism for that. I guess the most recent, most specific example I can think of is like when Lindy West and Jim Norton were on a show debating, having a conversation about Jim Norton felt that comics should be able to tell rape jokes if they want to, and Lindy West was like, well, you're turning this into the free speech issue it's not. And the whole thing about if you want to turn it into a free speech issue, like, if you want to write those jokes, that makes you a dick, and free speech dictates that I get to call you a dick if I want to.
It seems like such a strange hill to die on, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If everything you can make jokes about, pretty much anything, but I want to make jokes about this.
A thing I think about a lot is like Jerry Seinfeld was interviewed once about the lack of diversity in comedy. And he said, I don't care what you look like, funny is funny. And I think there's something really wrong with that statement, because funny is funny to who? Mm. Like, you'd watch comedians in cars getting coffee, and there's a certain archetype of person who gets to be in that car getting that coffee with Jerry Seinfeld. Funny, sure, funny can be funny, but funny is, like, Ted U. Cole's Twitter bio says, we who. And that, I think that's the perfect way to push back on that. We who? Who's finding it funny? Why are they finding it funny? Why am I not finding it funny? What is funny? Who dictates what is funny? Like, humor is subjective. Like, there isn't a... You can't say funny is funny with the expectation that all jokes, all funny jokes will be funny to everyone. Like, my friend and I can watch, like, the same episode of The Big Bang Theory, and he'll find it hilarious, and I'll just be sitting there going, don't get it. Don't know why this is funny.
Back to criminals. Do you have any favourite, like, literary baddies?
The Green Goblin. He's a pretty bad baddie from Spider-Man.
And what is it about him that appeals to you, other than he's sort of wrestling with your hero? Can I say that about Spider-Man? A hero?
Well, I mean, the Green Goblin is responsible for one of the most tragic moments in Spider-Man lore, because he's responsible for the death of Gwen Stacy, spoiler for, like, the 60s. If you, but also, like, he's basically, like...
I'm dropping my Don Draper coffee mug with sadness. He shattered my childhood now.
He works for... Like, he's a big, like, corporate man who owns this huge corporate empire, and yet... that amount of power isn't enough for him. And so I think there's something very telling about a certain archetype of man that Norman Osborn, aka the Green Goblin, represents. And it's the same with, I don't know why this guy came to me, Dudley Smith? In the, like, James Ellroy's L.A. Quartet books.
Oh.
Like, he's played by James Cromwell in L.A. Confidential. L.A. Confidential. But he's a pretty good baddie. Yeah.
Is that because he's sort of satisfying to hate, or because he's so complex? There's a texture to his badness, do you think?
I just think he's a really well-written bad dude in a book that's all about bad people. Like, he's the bad of the bad. You know, I read all those books as a teenager, and I really lapped them all up. But I think what Ellroy seems to do is, like, all his books seem to be... good people do bad things for good reasons, but Dudley Smith does bad things for bad reasons. Therefore, he's the bad baddie.
Standout bad guy.
Yeah.
Do you feel like we're in a time where crime and thrillers are a really, really popular genre in literature, but also podcasts, you know, sort of true crime, old murders? Why do you think we're so keen to know about these things?
Yeah.
Is there something about the time we're living that makes these extra popular, do you think?
I don't know, but I, like everyone else, was obsessed with season one of Serial. You know, it is. I think the format of storytelling is really compelling. Like, the thriller format, you know, where you sort of drip feed, drip feed, drip feed, cliffhanger, drip feed, drip. It's brilliant. It keeps people coming back. Whether the story has that much, like, mileage in it anyway, and that's what I don't... So I've just finished my first YA novel, which is a thriller about gentrification, and it's interesting. I've never written a thriller before, and I've set it in real time with four different narrators, so it's very complex. But
that's fantastic. Is that going to be out this year, or
yeah, it's out in June, I think. And it was really interesting writing it, because you kind of, like, I absorb a lot of thrillers and a lot of crime stuff, but I don't necessarily can see the mechanics of how you put it all together. Mm. So I kind of had to, like, learn the by numbers way of doing thrillers.
So I guess it was two different things that were new. Have you written any? You say it's your first YA book.
Yeah.
So it's a new audience and a new style.
Yeah. I don't know if the style is different. Like, I think what the only difference in writing YA for me is the age of the protagonist, I think. So when it was out on submission, what was really interesting was, like, it's a gentrification thriller with a conspiracy theory at the heart of it. I work with teenagers. I'm a youth worker. And so I know teenagers, spend a lot of time with teenagers, but a bunch of people in the publishing industry were like, yeah, I really get the landscape, but, like, teenagers don't really like conspiracy theories. And I was like, have you ever met a teenager? Have you ever been a teenager? Like,
we're thinking about getting some in for a focus group in 6 months. We'll ask them then.
I was like, when I was a teenager, I was obsessed with the X-Files, you know? Like, when you're a teenager, wherever you grow up, you like, most teenagers tend to grow up with this feeling that there is something beyond their control that is making them do stuff that they don't want to have to do, because like you're in a certain institutions for so long. Like, of course,
that's their life.
That is their life, and their life is very small. Like, of course teenagers lap up conspiracy theories. I just thought that was bonkers. But what those editors were saying was, I don't like conspiracy theories, and as a teenager, if I was a teenager now with my now brain, then I wouldn't like this. And I think, nah, I work with teenagers. I know what I'm doing.
You've got the source. I do think as well that...
I might be hoist by my own petard when the book comes out. And like, teenagers like, I loved everything but the conspiracy theory.
I don't know, you might not agree or you might feel differently. So my first job was at Bliss magazine, the teen mag. So I work with teenagers in a different way. And I loved that job very much, but... I feel as though teenagers have an incredibly keen sense of justice and what is right and what is wrong, get really, really angry about injustice, and they're really passionate about fighting that.
Yeah, I think up until probably the age of 14, 15, most teenagers would make really good policemen and women, just because everything's right and wrong, everything's black and white, like there are no grey areas. And it's only when you start to rebel and push back that you start to see the grey areas, and that's when the punks are born. And the anarchists and all the rest of it, I don't know. But my kid at the moment, she's three, and she would make an amazing police officer. She did the most sneaky thing,
robbed a bank.
Yeah, she robbed a bank, and I was really not sure she should have done that. No, I spilt some food on the floor, and I picked it up, and like she was like, "Mommy won't be happy about that." And I was like, "Don't worry about it. We just won't tell her. It's fine." I told my wife, and I was like, "Oh yeah, earlier on our kid, I spilled something," and our kid was like, "Oh, mummy won't be happy about that," and she was like, "Yeah, I spilled something the other day," and she was like, "Oh yeah, daddy won't be happy about that," and it's like she's playing us off against each other, which is the ultimate police.
Yes, faintly Orwellian. She's put us both in being watched.
She's put us both in different interrogation rooms.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We'll be back to Nikesh shortly. This week, my steal of the week, a book where the cover price belies the fact that it's worth its weight in gold, is The Little Snake by A.L. Kennedy. I've raved about this book all over social media and to the lady in charge of weekend upgrades on the Virgin train leaving Wolverhampton because I was sobbing so hard I couldn't use the chipping pin. This is a fable partly inspired by The Little Prince about the joy and pain that love brings, and the power of hope and believing in goodness. It reads like a prose poem, but Kennedy is such a verbal economist that it never becomes cloying or baroque. It is simply and starkly beautiful. It's a fairy story, especially for anyone who needs to believe in something good. It's out now, published by Canongate, and if you're a friend of mine, you may well be getting it in your stocking in a few weeks. Now back to Nikesh.
I would love to ask, because I think this is a question I'm aware that women get asked constantly and men rarely do, but you brought it up and I know we've touched on that, but you're saying about, I suppose, finding a routine and balancing the fact that you have 1,000 different jobs, from being, you know, a father and a youth worker and a novelist. And would you call yourself an activist? Is that fair, or would you rather not use that description for what you do in terms of, you know, widening participation in publishing?
I'm definitely not an activist. Like, I've met and worked with proper activists, and like, their dedication to the cause far exceeds mine. Like, I've done some campaign work, but the thing that I find frustrating about that campaign work is all I'm asking in the publishing industry, so it's already quite niche, is for a basic level of respect and equality so that we can have this equal playing field from which we can have a meritocracy that everyone seems to believe is there. And that is a very basic ask, and so I don't think I'm doing anything special by making that ask.
But then I do believe very strongly that a lot of the time we have to take things we can do and almost break it down and break it down. I was listening to a different podcast, The Guilty Feminist, which I think I could say I'm a big fan of, and there were activists who were fighting period poverty, and someone in the audience said, well, why this? Why not just focus on ending all poverty? And she was saying, well, obviously I'd like to. Who does not want that? But you have to take what you can do and what's around you, and then, you know, I think take the thing that's not, I mean, I don't think that what you do is, you know, small in any way, but it's perhaps, it's specific, certainly, and let it sort of bloom outwards.
I guess the thing is, I don't want people to forget that I'm a writer, first and foremost. And anything that I'm doing, I'd much rather be writing. Like, I sometimes feel like that Taylor Swift song, Look What You Made Me Do, because I'm like, I shouldn't have to be setting up an agency and doing this journal. The Goodham Grinch shouldn't even have to have existed in the first place. But they did, and they do, and I did it because no one else was going to do it, and I'd much rather have been writing. And, you know, it is hard because, like, all of this campaign work takes me away from my kids, and it takes me away from doing the thing that I love doing, and, like, it means that I say I don't ever want to do another diversity panel, and yet I did a whole year and a half of effectively doing the diversity panel by talking about The Good Immigrant so much. And, you know, I just want to write. I just want to write, like, books with the confidence of a mediocre white man like Jonathan Franzen, you know? And people don't ask Jonathan Franzen, like...
You will never write books like Jonathan Franzen, because I will read them and I will laugh and cry and not fall asleep.
Well, TBC. But, you know, no one asked Jonathan Franzen, like, how we can diversify publishing, or how can I be a better white ally to people from... like people of colour and all this sort of stuff.
Or how he juggles looking after his kids.
Or how he juggles looking after his kids. And, like, so here's the thing about juggling writing and kids. Like, when my second baby was born, sleep is obviously a big issue in any household with anyone, really. Anyone with a mobile phone is going to have sleep problems. But, you know, I guess specifically with kids, I was on a big novel deadline, and I knew that, like, in order for the rest of the house to, like, to be able to sleep, I needed to, like, step up, because I don't have to do the days. Like, I get to go to work, and I get to have a shower because I'm going to work. I get to go to work and have adult conversations about things that
aren't about who's dropped food on the floor.
Yeah, like, I get to make decisions. I get to choose what I want for lunch. All these kinds of things, like, and that's a real privilege. And so, like, the least I can do is ensure that people at home have some time to sleep. And our baby was born in summer, so I basically spent the first 2 months of her life with her in a sling, walking her around Bristol in the summer evenings. So she would have a good, like, and that would send her into at least a 4 hour sleep. And then I'd come home and I'd edit for 2 hours, like, standing up with my laptop perched on, like, a mantelpiece.
What are you going to say on your child?
On my child. Sometimes on my child, if I was tired. It is how my child met, how my baby met Naina Cherry, which is quite special.
Can you tell us that story?
Well, yeah, but basically there was a documentary about Naina Cherry, and she was at the watershed, and as part of my walk, I thought, I might just swing by and see if I can look at Naina Cherry in the flesh. That'd be pretty cool. And I came in, and, like, the cinema curator saw me and, like, brought Naina Cherry over to meet my baby. And Naina Cherry was like, oh my God, there's a baby here.
That's so cool. Did your baby wake up for the occasion, or will you have to tell them that they slept through this momentous event?
There's a photo of her and Naina Cherry, and she's fast asleep. That's how I balanced it. So having the 2 hours of editing time, I had to trade that off with, like, doing the walk, so I could ensure that my baby was asleep. And that was like the least you can do. Like, it's not even doing that much, you know.
I think it sounds quite soothing, have a lovely, snuggly warm baby and then do it. But then I hate editing and I find it horrible. Do you enjoy it? What's your favourite part of the writing process?
I really like being edited or doing the editorial process. I think because traditionally, because I've balanced writing with other stuff, I tend to do my first draft quickly and with caveats. So like, I know that this bit needs work and I know this bit's a bit weak and this bit's a bit low wattage and needs ramping up and all the rest of
it. Put in 400 pages of sad.
Yeah, put in 400 pages of sad. Just do the inciting, you know, sad mug bit and then, you know, take the rest of it out. So like, I'll do the first draft quite quickly and then like the editing and like shaping it into something that I like is the fun part for me. Like the first bit when you're like, oh, I've got to make them, like, I've got to get them from here to there, and along the way this needs to happen, and that's kind of almost unwieldy to write sometimes.
And it's because I struggle with that because I think, oh, but I have to come back and do this again and I might hate it and it might be terrible. Some days I think that I really would just like to write a load of words, put the words in a box, have a check appear in another box, not even, you know, having to go and like check your bank balance and see who's paid you. You've just got it sort of magically comes and then not see anyone and just...
Why check? Why not just like a counter above your desk?
Oh, like... that would be good. If there was a magic bank where you could just see the money going in, it wasn't telling you how much was going out. I think I could deal with that. But the sort of, you just put some paper in, get some paper out, that system would suit me fine.
This may sound like quite self-loathing, but I really need to hate the words. I really need to hate it in order to make it better. Like the moment I'm like, this is great, is the moment I need to give it to someone else.
I mean, that makes me think you will never, ever be friends in, and I mean that as a great compliment.
But
we're going to get into so much trouble, aren't we?
But it's not so much that, it's more like, I know, I'm using these books and essays to kind of wrestle with things that are really troubling me. So, like, each book needs to be either markedly different from the one that came before it or, like, a step up for me. So between Meat Space and this book that's coming out in April, there is another book. It's called Wild Loaves. I wrote it very quickly after I finished Meat Space in, like, I can't remember when I finished it, maybe 2013. So I wrote it very, very quickly. It didn't take me very long. And it's like a nice light rom-com about two people who get ditched by their friends at a music festival, and then they through circumstances end up to like doing the festival together and falling in love. And it's like, it's fine, but it's quite light. And I wasn't really wrestling with anything with it. And so I was like, I don't need this to be a thing that comes out. So I stuck it in a drawer and I was like, right, I'm going to write the thing that I've been trying to write since I was 19. And I'm going to try and get it right. And I managed to get it wrong again. And then I was listening to a podcast interview with Mitch Hurwitz, who created Arrested Development. And he was talking about how most American sitcoms are based in this commedia dell'arte thing about the matriarch, the patriarch, the craftsman, and the clown. So if you look at like Seinfeld is your matriarch because everyone nests at his apartment. Elaine is your patriarch because she's like the career-minded, ambitious one. Kramer is always scheming, he's your craftsman, and George is your clown. And you put them all in one room and you give them a desire or a want and chaos ensues. And that was the thing that I needed to listen to make me go, I know what this book needs to be. So I'm really glad I stuck that other book in a drawer, and I'm not, I don't know, I might revisit it when I need to fart something out, maybe, I don't know.
I think it sounds charming.
It is a fun book, but like, it was the book that I did instead of doing this one. And like, sometimes you need to listen to a podcast and hear someone say something really pretentious about commedia dell'arte in order for you to go, huzzah, I have it. This is what it's going to be. And the other thing that someone once told me was that a lot of sitcom plots because sitcoms have this sort of big reset at the end of each episode, most of them have a very clear want. So like, I guess the most obvious example is the catchphrase of Only Fools and Horses is, this time next year we'll be millionaires. And so you know in each episode what the desire is. They want to be millionaires.
And that you know, they will not get that until the very end when they do. In Needles and Horses.
And so each episode follows this the plot structure of Cinderella. So, like, the characters have this clear want. They want to go to the ball, they want to be millionaires. Something stands in their way. They can't go to the ball, or they can't be millionaires. And then they chase what they're looking for, and they eventually get what they're looking for, and then it turns out to be not what they expected, and then reset. So, like, going back to what we were saying about comedy before, like, these structures and these tropes and this sort of, like, ease of ways into characters was exactly what I needed to hear for, this novel that's, like, ambitious for me, but it's a novel about the human condition, and why wouldn't I, like, exploit some very well-worn archetypes in order to examine the human condition?
Sure, they're archetypes for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think it's really, really comforting for any writer to hear that you don't do it and it's done. And sometimes it takes years, and sometimes you don't find what you need immediately as you write. It's you think, or as you say, you hear a podcast.
Yeah. Well, I guess the classic example is what was Go Set a Watchman became To Kill a Mockingbird, because someone read Go Set a Watchman and they were like, actually, this one bit where Scout is a child is much more interesting than... So, like...
Because it would crush me, coming from an editor. It's like, those 20 pages you did, can the whole book be those and get rid of everything else?
I love it. I specifically love this small bit. So delete everything else and turn this... triple this small bit and we'll be fine.
I have sulked over much, much, much less. I wanted to ask you about your worst reading habit. Is it borrowing books and never giving them back? Is it leaving books on trains? Is it doing that thing where you don't put a bookmark in, you just put them on the floor? Or using old junk for bookmarks?
I don't lend people books anymore unless I know it's a spare copy. Like, you know, when you work in publishing, you're lucky. Like, sometimes you get doubles, and you, like, I don't mind giving those out. People don't like it when you dog-ear pages. I dog-ear pages.
Oh, gee, is that when you bend them back so you know where you are?
Sorry, world. Controversial. This is my confession.
Why do you think people get so upset about that? Because I can sort of see, you know, I guess we're all taught that we should be careful with our things, but I do think that with books, more than anything else, it's a weird, almost fetishistic sense that they're preciousness, and that they're, you know, there's something sacred, which is lovely, but also really irritating.
No, I can see that. I think my worst habit is I junk books really quickly. Like, I can tell within, like, 30 to 40 pages whether I'm going to like something or not. And I think that sometimes means that I don't always read out of my comfort zone as much as I should. And I should stay with books a bit longer.
How much time do you think you spend reading? I'm sure it depends on, you know, you and what you're doing, but...
I try and do half an hour a day, which I think for me with young kids and, like, my ridiculous to-do list is not
awful. I think that's
awful.
Pretty laudable.
So one thing I noticed, like, with my sleep habits was I was sleeping really badly. And, like, you read all this stuff online about, like, having your phone in the same room. And when you've got a kid, like, and they wake. And so, like, we'd keep our phones in our room just so we could see what time it was. And, like, in case it was a feed, or, like, whether it was time to get up or what have you. So I took all my all my notifications off my home screen on my phone, which was amazing. When I want to check Twitter or my email, I will go into Twitter or my email. I'm trying to do a thing where half an hour before I go to bed, I don't look at a screen, because, like, apparently it keeps you awake for a bit longer, or it doesn't help you with REM. So I try and do half an hour of reading before I go to bed, which, I mean, sometimes isn't very successful, but we can try.
So do you ever reread books, or do you feel as though there are just too many books to begin to do that?
I haven't done in years. The last book I reread, actually, no, that's not true. I am rereading a bunch of books at the moment for the Folio Prize. That are books that I read in the last year.
Do you get the beautiful Folio editions?
I hope so. That'd be amazing. So, like, a bunch of books that I really loved last year that were submitted for the prize, I'm rereading them now with, like, a more judgmental eye, and seeing if, like, they match up So that's nice. The book I reread recently, A, because it's brilliant, and B, because I was very close to trying to work on an adaptation of it, but it didn't quite work out, was White Tears by Hari Kunzru. And it's a brilliant book about the blues and cultural appropriation and hipsters. And I started to talk to like a Hollywood executive about adapting it, and then like for various reasons it didn't quite work out. But yeah, rereading that was a real joy, because like I was rereading it to kind of think about how I might adapt it, but then because it's like a weird ghost story thriller, you kind of tear through it quite quickly. So like reading stuff where you're forced to slow down because you kind of need to read it for work or you need to read it for judging it is rare, but it's really delightful.
Nikesh, you've been fantastic. As a thank you for helping the book inspectors with their inquiries, I will be issuing you with a book token. I'd like to know what book you would be spending the token on.
I'll tell you what, I really love Jamie McKelvey's and Kieran Gillen's The Wicked and the Divine, and I'm a bit behind on my comic reading, so I might get the latest volume of the Wicked and Divine comics.
Huge thanks to our guest, Nikesh. His latest novel, The One Who Wrote Destiny, published by Atlantic Books, is available now, and you can also buy his first book for teenagers, Run Riot, published by Hodder Children's. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow book inspectors. You can find me on social media, at NotRollerGirl on Twitter, and at the Daisy B, that's B like the insect, on Instagram. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and all of the books they talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at ybooked@gmail.com. That's the letter Y, booked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next week for another literary peep show.